Welcome back, aliens, ghosts, and robots all, to An Invisible Sun, Chapter 6. Hi, this is Keith. Hope you're doing well. As I'm recording this, it has just been Labor Day weekend here in the United States. Now, most people here think of Labor Day as a day you get to take off from work, a long weekend, and that's fine, nothing wrong with that. What I find interesting, though, is that's almost the exact opposite of what Labor Day used to be. Many years ago, Labor Day was a day to celebrate what it meant to be a skilled craftsman. Tradespeople and craftspeople of all kinds on Labor Day would invite people to come and watch them work. They would have festivals and tours. It was a day to celebrate making things with your hands, learning passed down from generation to generation, a day to celebrate what it meant to be a part of a community that built things for each other and helped each other and created together. Of course, many of the jobs that were celebrated back then are gone. That's the way technology works. And we still face this today. And the creative arts are also under threat from generative AI. That's one of the reasons I want you to support independent creators like me, people who have learned the craft and have found the art, people who have spent time finding their own voice and a way to speak to you that is hopefully entertaining and enlightening. As our art becomes more and more computerized and formulized and algorithmatized, the indie creators are the last ones telling the true, new, authentic stories. Okay, let's get into the episode. An Invisible Sun by W. Keith Timms. Chapter 6. According to their network site, Eyes of the World, the group where I found the Invisible Sun lecture by Sister Lucy, had in-person meetings every Thursday night, 2000 hours, upstairs at Club Soma, which was where I went, walking along darkened streets, searching among unnumbered old buildings. It turned out the place was hard to miss. Purple neon spelled out Cyrillic letters across a black brick doorframe, and I felt a deep bass rumble within, flowing through the wet sidewalk to my feet. There was a drizzle in the warm October air, though I was sheltered by an overpass high above. The drops trickled down the brick walls and through the cracks in the bridge overhead. I developed another cut, another lesion, last night. This one was on my back, between my shoulder blades. By the time I realized it, another of my shirts was ruined. It was awkward to staunch the bleeding, but fortunately it was small and scabbed over quickly. The bullet wound in my shoulder had healed some more. It was sore and stiff, but these were not the only wounds I was dealing with. I was lost. Ken Zinn's bullet had severed some sort of anchor line holding my life in place, and I was drifting. I am drifting. My sleep, when I got it, was filled with dreams of anxious, vague images, like those painted on Zinn's wall, and the sweating, the ache in my joints, and the sound of blood rushing in my ears. I did consider going to a doctor, but I remembered what Mrs. Zinn said about people going to the hospital sick, like her son was, and not coming back. I remembered the way Detective Wright ducked my question about Zinn's weight. More research was required. Answers. There must be answers. Once inside, the low, sustained howl of Club Soma's electronic drones vibrated in me, down to my bones. Pools of light in purple, blue, and red illuminated the otherwise dark club. There were a few people here, huddling around tables or standing entranced near the DJ's stage, where a woman in a blank latex mask languidly operated a bank of computerized instruments. Almost no one in the place moved. They sat or stood in slumped and crooked postures, like so many wound down toys. Right by the entrance, however, a black curtain partially concealed a stairwell that led up to the floor above. The ocean of sound faded into a background rumble as I hurried up the stairs. The second floor, some sort of converted warehouse space, had a dark hallway with a grungy bathroom at one end. However, at the other end, bright light spilled from a doorway, and I could make out quiet voices over the drone of the music below.
Now, that wasn't the first time, either. In 12 different cases, once the ambulance dropped them off, all the victims were moved off the regular floor within an hour of arrival, sometimes as quickly as 5 minutes.
I peeked into the open door and found a large storage room, almost as big as the club below. The windows had been painted black, and light shined through old decorative grates in the ceiling. Boxes of liquor and old sound equipment lined the walls, storage for the club below, I suppose. But the center of the room was open and set up with folding chairs, enough for 30 or so. Only 8 people were using them, though, sitting toward the front and listening to the speaker. Behind him, a slideshow projection played in the air, depicting hospital rooms in a kind of before and after arrangement. First, with ghastly, scrawny patients in them, and then again empty. The pictures were grainy and poorly composed, as if taken surreptitiously. The speaker scratched his full beard.
I searched the hospitals wherever my security pass would let me go, but I could never find them.
A woman sitting in the front row nodded enthusiastically. I couldn't see her very well from the back of the room, but there was a kind of frothing zeal in her voice.
The doctors are in on it, of course.
The bearded man considered this and then shook his head.
In all honesty, I don't think so. Not directly, anyway. I think they believe the stories. They think it's some kind of new blood disorder and refer the victims to whatever special medical program the government has told them is set up.
My first instinctive reaction was to smirk at the accusations of conspiracy. But this was what I came for, wasn't it? A man at the back of the audience glanced toward the door and spied me. He got up and scurried over to meet me as unobtrusively as possible. I recognized him from the All Saints Station protest, the man in glasses, yelling at the crowd, dragged away by police. He had old bruises on his face.
"Hi,"
he said, his reedy voice hushed so as not to disturb the speaker.
"Can I help you?"
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. But I think I was at one of your protests recently. The one at All Saints Station.
The man's expression turned wary.
"Look, we have a right to protest. We have to make people see the truth. No, I'm not angry."
He relaxed a bit now, adjusting his glasses as he looks me over.
"Oh, okay. So why are you here?" "I guess I'm curious."
That seemed to please him, and he nodded.
Good. You want to know what's going on? That's great. Come on in. I'm Walter. Christopher."
We shook hands.
"Nice to meet you, Chris. You want some coffee?"
I didn't, but I want to be polite.
It's Christopher, and sure.
Walter led me to a folding table set up with a decanter of coffee and some plastic-wrapped Danish. There were a couple of tablet computers there, too, showing pictures of previous protests and various manifestos. He poured me a cup of the fake black coffee, steam rising from the paper cup.
"So, you saw the All Saints Station protest. What did you think?"
I took the coffee from him, scanning the other people present. I didn't recognize anyone else. I'd rather he didn't remember me, either, as the man trampled by the crowd. I doubted he would, really. Nevertheless, I avoided eye contact.
It was, effective.
Walter nodded proudly.
Our biggest effort to date. A lot of people had their eyes opened that day. A lot of us got hurt, too, but we knew the risks.
He glanced over his shoulder to that middle-aged woman with the zealous voice. Could it have been her, sewn up in the sheet? The one that fell atop me?
Yes. And, it made a lot of people angry as well, I think. Yeah, well, so sorry that people get to work 5 minutes late when there are people dying.
And now, for the real question. The first of two that have been simmering in my head, feeding my ravenous insomnia for days.
About that, is there really some sort of plague? There is. So, what is it?
Walter's conviction faltered a moment, eyes narrowing and his mouth twisting in distaste.
That's the real problem. We don't know exactly what it is, where it comes from, or how it spreads. It's real, though. We see the symptoms. Weight loss, weakness, skin disorders, slow organ failure, in some cases dementia. But the cause, whoever knows, isn't telling.
I nodded to the speaker on the other side of the room.
Could it be a new kind of blood disease or something?
His answer sounded rehearsed, as if straight from his group's boilerplate.
It might be, but there is a systematic and comprehensive effort in all levels of government to suppress and conceal all information regarding this illness. If it's a genuinely new disease, why all the secrecy? Now, there's something more to this than another nutrition disorder or a mutated virus. They're protecting the cause.
And now, for the second question. I stared at the coffee in my hand, the shimmering surface reflecting my tired eyes.
And, how do you know if you have this plague? We're working on a blood test.
I look up at him, and then around this dingy warehouse, and the handful of people attending the lecture.
We? Well, when I say we, I mean there's a network of like-minded groups all dedicated to exposing the plague for what it is. And at some of the higher levels, they've been working out a blood test.
I see. I had hoped for something more definitive. I craved certainty, even if the news is bad.
There's a few theories. I think it's some biological weapon that got released.
He hooks his thumb toward the speaker at the podium.
Leon thinks it's the rats. Some kind of new bubonic plague or something. So, I guess there's no cure, either.
I put down my untouched coffee on the table, next to one of the tablets.
Unfortunately, no. We're working on that, too, but we don't even know what it is yet. That's why our work is so important.
More questions. Vague answers are hardly answers at all. They only lead to more questions, and my brain simmered with them, overflowing.
How'd you find us, anyway? I looked up your group after the protest and found your network site. Good. We try to be a place to collect all the information we can. Did you look through our archives?
Yes, I did. There was one that stuck out, a lecture by Sister Lucy?
Oh, yeah. The Invisible Sun. They're right at the top, leaning the way, you know? Without them, we'd be all over the place, unorganized.
So they're a group as well.
Yeah, great people. Very serious. Warriors for the cause.
I looked around at the handful of people here, a little hope rising in me.
Is Sister Lucy here?
Walter's eyes widened.
I wish. I've asked her to come speak a dozen times, but her schedule is totally booked. Not to mention, security reasons.
What do you mean? It's a whole trumped-up charge thing. They say she stole money from the church. It's all false, of course. But they'll arrest her if they can.
Oh.
I kept looking, but I can already see that the other man I'm thinking of isn't here.
There was someone else at the protest. A big man. Broad, strong, with tattoos all over.
Walter thought about that.
Yeah, he was there. He looked after Fatima there when she got trampled. I've seen him around at other actions. Not one of our regulars, but we have a lot of people from other groups show up all the time to help with large projects. Any idea what group he might belong to?
Walter narrowed his eyes.
No. Why? I got knocked over by the crowd, and he helped me up. I wanted to thank him.
It was technically true, but it was becoming clear to me that I won't find what I need here, above this club.
Sorry, but look, if you want to get involved, Eyes of the World is one of the most active and proactive groups in the Metro. Here, take a look.
He slides one of the tablets closer to me, touching their screens to activate a library.
Here's a bunch of news articles about our activities and the effects we've had. There's images and video from some of our other protests. You can see we're serious about affecting people. Confrontation forces change, you know?
I didn't argue his logic. Instead, I browsed. All sorts of articles and pictures flashed up on the index. I feigned interest, tapping through a few. A video popped up of many angry people holding up banners and shaking signs at crowds who, in turn, pretended they didn't exist. Walter unwrapped the Danish tray.
All Saints Station marks a milestone for us. We're heading in a new direction, taking things to the next level. We can really use good people on the front lines. And you know, if in-person involvement isn't your thing, that's okay. We take donations and put the money to good use.
The video played on as I nodded absently to Walter's sales pitch. Rows of faces paraded past as the camera operator pans over the Eyes of the World demonstrators. When I saw Evan's face, I was too astonished to pause the video. My trembling fingers fluttered over the screen to rewind it. It could not be. Could it? I found the moment in the video and froze the image. It was him. The mop of white hair on his balding head, the gnomish grin, the odd squint. Evan Grieg, my last real friend. I could not fathom why he would be in this video, among the protesters. Is this why he was wanted by the police?
You want a Danish?
I pointed out Evan's face on the screen.
That man, do you know him? Oh, sure. That's Evan.
This man knew Evan?
He was a member? For a while, yeah. A few years back. A retired teacher, I think. He was really involved, but he got to know some of the higher-ups and started working more with them.
Walter's jealousy is obvious, no matter how much he tries to conceal it.
How do you know him? He was my best friend. And you didn't know he worked in the movement?
I shook my head. How did I not know this about him?
Huh. Well, some people keep their political life separate. He was a nice guy, though.
I began flipping through the other pictures and videos, searching for Evan's face, but I didn't find him. I don't understand it. He never seemed to have secrets. With me, with his colleagues or his students, Evan seemed so open, honest, and giving. The rare kind of person around whom you could lower your guard and be honest with in return.
I think Leon's about finished. You should stay and meet some people.
I flipped back to the video frame of my friend.
Thanks, but I was really just curious.
Walter grimaced a little, like a salesman who lost a lead.
Yeah, I understand. Look, it's a lot to accept. I know, I didn't want to believe it either. But the plague is real, and we've got to let people know about it. So, you know, think about it. And if you change your mind and want to be part of something important, come on back. Okay, Chris?
Yeah, sure, okay. Thanks.
The rain had stopped when I exited Club Soma, but the downspouts from the overpass were still gushing runoff into the gutters. My shadow grew longer as I walked toward the transit station a few blocks away, cast by purple neon Cyrillic. I thought I knew everything about Evan. I spent many nights with his wife Padma and him, drinking wine and talking about literature and food, my love of Victoriana, his fascination with Balinese culture, but never politics, never conspiracy, never the plague. When Padma died, it became just him and me. But even then, nothing changed. How had he hidden all this from me? I felt like the butt of some universal private joke.
Good evening, Dr. Cousins.
I froze. I had only been paying half attention to my surroundings. Dangerous at night, no matter what part of the metro. Standing next to a parked police hover car stood Detective Wright, imposing in his blue trench coat, casually reading his tablet, his attention divided between it and me.
Detective Wright?
I said, struggling to bury the sudden anxiety crawling up my spine and into my scalp. I hadn't done anything wrong, had I? There's nothing illegal about attending a meeting, is there?
I'm surprised. I wouldn't have picked you for a fan of drone music.
I shot a glance at the club behind me.
Well, I just thought I'd try something new. Turns out it's not really my thing after all.
Wright smiled faintly, swiping a finger over the screen of his tablet.
It is good to try new things now and again. Though you must be careful you don't end up getting in over your head.
I forced myself to take a few steps closer to the policeman.
I'm not sure I follow.
The detective's little smile was only a twitch at the corner of his mouth, hardly disturbing the rest of his strong face.
Well, you have been visiting some dangerous places lately. This isn't the safest of neighborhoods. And then you were down in underground. Very risky. You've been following me? Me? No. But you did make an emergency services call from underground last week, didn't you?
Of course. They would have traced my number, even if I didn't give my name.
I did. I visited Mrs. Zinn. There was a man who looked very sick out in the hallway. I wanted to help him.
Admirable. Still, underground is not safe. And the meeting you attended tonight. Bit out of your element, aren't you? You should be more careful.
I should have taken his hint, muttered an apology and gone home. But I was tired of his smug smirk and roundabout threats. He knew something.
Is there something you want to tell me, Detective? I'm certain you didn't wait for me out here to ensure I got to the transit station safely.
Wright slipped his tablet into his coat pocket and then folded his thick arms over his chest.
Actually, I'm off duty now. I'm not here in any sort of official capacity. But I do understand why you're out here. It's the same reason I am out here. You've got puzzling evidence that you want to make sense of. You have questions you cannot answer. So do I. But where you and I are different is that I am equipped to go search for these answers. You are not. Why? Because you have a badge? I'm not stupid, Detective. No, you are not. But you are naive. We are not the only ones who spend sleepless nights wondering how Ken Zen's end came to him. About who might already know why. And there are others who are not as scrupulous as you and I. People who have the potential to do more than theatrics at a train station.
I remembered Walter's words then. All Saints Station marks a milestone for us. We're heading in a new direction, taking things to the next level.
And? You're telling me this out of the goodness of your heart? Yes. Why not? Believe it or not, I don't want to see you get hurt. So tell me what's going on. Tell me what you know. I can't. I have no evidence yet. Nothing I can point to. And the police, like the hospitals, are discouraged from looking too closely. But I do know that dangerous powers are fighting over whatever this is. You don't want to get involved. Then what would you have me do, Detective? Go home. Get some sleep. Read a book. Get on with your life. Really, that's all any of us can do. I see. Get on with my life. Tell me, Detective, exactly how much more of that do I have left?
His expression remained a mask of calm control. He was more practiced at that than I am. But he does not answer, which itself is kind of an answer.
I see. Spare me your concern for my well-being, then. Good night.
My insides churned all the way back to my apartment, but I couldn't tell if I was sick or angry. I hung up my coat and hat, locked up, and left the lights off. On the small sofa, I could just make out my outline in the reflection of the video screen on the opposite wall. A part of me wanted to take Detective Wright's advice, forget all this, and try to reclaim my routine. But to do that, I would have to convince myself that the cycle of work and home brought comfort, that teaching my students was valuable, that my friend didn't keep secrets from me. I would have to convince myself that there wasn't something wrong with me, after all. And how in all the world was I ever going to be able to do that? I picked up the tablet from the sofa and connected it to the video screen. It came on, a hot and unnatural pale blue. I ran my fingers through my hair, plucked at my shirt, did my best to look presentable before I started recording.
Evan, it's Christopher,
I said to the screen, sitting up straight, trying to smile.
I know it's been a long time since we've talked, and I'm sorry about that. I was just thinking about you today and wondered what you were up to.
How much should I share? Best to be circumspect.
There was an incident at the university. I was shot by one of my students. I'm fine. But I'm on sabbatical until spring. So, if you, I'm at home most of the time, if you wanted to reach me. Anyway, let me know what's going on with you, will you? It would be nice to get back in touch.
A tap on the screen and the recording stopped. I hope it was enough to get a response from him, but I was wary of telling him the whole truth lest I scare him off. I sent the recording to the last known number I had for him. If he still lives on Mars, it would be about 10 minutes before the message arrived there at this time of year. I fell into bed a few minutes later. I didn't expect to sleep much. When I did, my dreams were filled with ghosts, black within black, who made a sound like a pulse, rising and falling. An Invisible Sun is written, produced, performed, and composed by W. Keith Timms and is a production of Alien Ghost Robot Creative Media. If you're enjoying the story, please tell your friends and family about it and leave stars or reviews on your favorite podcast platforms. I hope you'll join us on our Discord server or sign up for our mailing list so we can stay in touch. Members of our Patreon get to hear future episodes early plus other cool perks for all our shows. Go to InvisibleSunPod.com for more information.